The next case the panel will consider is Verado versus City of Philadelphia, appellate number 25-2279.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Adam Zabrigan from the City of Philadelphia Law Department for the appellant, City of Philadelphia et al. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That'd be granted.
Now, there are two issues presented by this appeal, and we recognize there's a third issue that this court raised with a focus order. But with this court's permission, I'd like to begin with the issue of single incident liability, whether the district court properly submitted to the jury plaintiff's 1983 municipal liability failure to train claim, which was premised on a single incident alone. Now, this court held last year in two separate presidential opinions, Hightower and Miller, that single incident liability for failure to train is vanishingly rare, and it exists only in extreme cases. And those cases generally involve categorical failures to train. The prime example is the one that the Supreme Court hypothesized in Canton. That was the example of a municipality that arms its police officers with firearms and provides no training whatsoever in when it's appropriate to use them. That's the kind of situation, if ever, when single incident liability exists. That's not what we have here. What we have here at bottom is plaintiff's claim that the City of Philadelphia should have trained its officers in the specifics of the knock and announce rule as it applied to this warrant execution, where the officers believed that they had a multi-unit row house. They believed that the front door was going to lead them, it was an exterior door that was going to lead them inside, and they were going to find further interior doors, and they were going to make a further knock and announce.
But the Philadelphia standard operating procedures don't distinguish between doors that lead directly into the dwelling versus doors that lead to a common area. So if one were to be informed by the training, the SOPs make no difference between those two things. So how do you respond to that training difference?
That's true, Your Honor. The SOPs do not distinguish. So plaintiff's claim is that the officers should have received some additional training that would have alerted them specifically that failing to conduct a fulsome knock and announce, even when they believed it was an exterior door, would violate the Fourth Amendment. And that's a very nuanced type of training. That's not a categorical failure to train like we were talking about in Canton with arming police officers and providing no training whatsoever. That's a very specific type of training. And what this court has said in Hightower and Miller, what the Supreme Court has said, that in those kinds of failure to train claims, you have to show, in order to prove the deliberate indifference that's required under 1983, you have to show a pattern of previous instances of similar constitutional violations so that the jury could conclude that the city was on notice that its training program was deficient. And we don't have that here. The plaintiff essentially has two theories. One, we did prove prior instances of constitutional violations that are similar. They did not. When you look at the trial transcript testimony of the testimony that's cited, it invariably is a situation in which the officer unremarkably says when asked, is what you did that day consistent with your training? Yes, it was
consistent. Well, what about Sergeant Kevin Melody, Appendix 162, so 161 and 162. He is asked, in looking at how this, quote, job, close quote, was done, quote, is it consistent with the training and the way you're expected to conduct knock and announce rules per your SOP, question mark, close quote. And his response say, I would say no. So that seems to convey, and you tell me whether I'm wrong, that Sergeant Melody said, no, this did not comport with the SOP.
Your Honor, I believe actually Sergeant Melody had said yes earlier in the testimony and then said no. And even
what do
though,
I do with, what do I do with this, though?
This what you do with this is saying it's not consistent with my training and experience cuts against the plaintiff's argument. Plaintiff's argument in saying that what the officer said was that what they did that day was consistent with their experience and training is that the city affirmatively trained them to violate the knock and announce rule. They basically say you infer from the fact that they were trained to do it this way, or they did it consistent with their training, that they were affirmatively trained to violate the knock and announce rule.
So kind of what you're saying is that Sergeant Melody's testimony makes it more likely that he's liable, but less likely that the city's liable.
Precisely, Judge Phipps, because the idea there is that if that were true, if he were violating what he said in his training, that might make him individually liable, but it wouldn't be a fault of the city for for failing to train because he's saying there, no, I did something inconsistent with my training. So that actually cuts against the plaintiff.
Isn't there essentially a disconnect here? A lot of the officer's testimony had to do with training regarding common area situations. So when they said, is this consistent with your training? No, because we really weren't trained with common area. And the district court opinion, there's not one mention of multi-unit or common area. The district court opinion is about total knock and announce. But Officer Miller, is it Miller?
Monk, the lieutenant?
No, not Melody. He says, this wasn't a knock and announce situation. It's like the lobby of an apartment building.
But precisely.
So we're not really in knock and announce world. We're in common area world where they probably weren't trained. And the question is, does that rise to the level that the city's on notice? We have no, is there anything in the record about the city being put on notice about common area problems?
No, Your Honor. And I think what you say is exactly right. There are really two different aspects of the Fourth Amendment violation that's alleged here. One is that the officers should have done more to surveil this property and learn that
that's not our appeal.
And that's, well, it's not, the plaintiff's brief doesn't address that at all. We address it in our opening brief and we say, look, that if that's the alleged Fourth Amendment violation that we're talking about here, right, there's no previous
Fourth Amendment about privacy or expectation of privacy either. We don't have that.
We don't have anything in the record, Your Honor, that would suggest the city would be on notice that it needed to train its officers to do something more to reconnoiter this property and determine, either obtain a floor plan or something like that.
Have four mailboxes and one door. Can you assume that there's four doors inside, or is there a possibility there's no? But there's nothing in there to say that the city was put on notice of that.
Absolutely nothing in the record.
Am I correct that it was Lieutenant Monk who gave the command to breach the door?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Did he testify, was his understanding, to his belief based upon the two mailboxes, that they were entering into a common area?
He did, Your Honor. He did.
Why did they even knock and announce to begin with? Why didn't they just go through the door?
I think it's an abundance of caution. Like, okay, we're going to make a knock and announce. We're going to see if anybody responds. We're going to give a short period of time. Nobody responds. We're anticipating a further interior door where we're going to make another knock and announce. Let's go ahead and make that knock and announce. It was short. No response, enter, and that's when they learn they were mistaken. So you're right, Your Honor, that there's those two separate aspects of Fourth Amendment, which we've just talked about, the alleged unreasonableness in terms of reconnoitering the property. What the district court focused on and what the plaintiff focuses on in her brief is the failure to make a fulsome knock and announce, and it fails for the same reason. There's no previous instance, not one single one, much less a pattern, that would have put the city on notice that there was a training deficiency such that the city could be found deliberately indifferent. It went to the jury based on a single incident alone. And again, we're talking about the nuances of what the knock and announce rule requires and when it requires it with regards to what kind of door the officers are anticipating facing.
Your view is that JNOV should be vacated.
JNOV should have been granted by the district court, Your Honor. It wasn't here. This court should direct entry of JNOV.
We would say there's no reasonable reading under this record that even if the district court had reached that issue, or do we send it back for the district court to apply the right standard of notice?
I don't think you have to do that, Your Honor, because we have a full trial record here, all the evidence that was put forward, and the evidence is insufficient to go to a jury on a single incident theory of liability, and there's no evidence of a pattern that would be sufficient for deliberate indifference under that, the normal type of municipal liability for failure to train. So simply, judgment as a matter of law should have been entered by the district court, and this court here should direct it.
Press the instructions. I found it curious. The district court's instructions are different from the standard it applied in the JNOV. In fact, the standard in the JNOV is much stricter, if you will, whereas the instructions, to my mind, are not necessarily correct statement of law.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think there
is
no
appendix 1100, 1111.
Yes, Your Honor. And so that's the instruction on municipal liability. To be clear, there is no standard Third Circuit model jury instruction dealing with single incident liability specifically.
Was that how this jury instruction got modified? Because I have some question about process. Who offered the charge to the court to give, and was it modified in some way to deal with that very point?
It was modified, Your Honor. There was a charge largely crafted by the plaintiff, is my understanding. We did object to it below as not adequately capturing the standard from Connick in terms of the high bar that's set. And the win.
Did you offer counter language?
We did offer a jury instruction, and it was not used. It had additional language in terms of the standard in Connick, and that's, it's not in the appendix, but I can provide the original record site on the instruction is document 62 of the district court. The way in which I'll say the way in which the standard instruction varies is the history of mishandling. There are three elements of deliberate indifference. The whether the city was aware that its employees would confront a particular situation, two, whether there was a history of mishandling that situation, and that deals with the pattern of previous instances that you normally have. That was modified to, is there an obvious need for training? That's on 1101 of the appendix, and that was modified presumably to capture the single.
Did the city object to that characterization before the court after that modification?
We objected to that instruction generally as not adequately capturing the high bar that's set for single incident liability. And the language that we proposed in document 62 was...
Are you saying docket 62?
Yes, docket number 62.
Number 62?
Yes, Your Honor, below. And that was, it had language regarding highly predictable. And so we did think that was more specific than just an obvious need for training. But I would just reemphasize that our argument on judgment as a matter of law doesn't turn at all on the jury instruction, because the district court should simply have not have submitted this question to the jury. It didn't need to craft instruction because it should have granted Rule 50 judgment as a matter of law.
Assume we declined to disturb the district court's decision on the judgment as a matter of law. You move to basically a remitter discussion. We have a very deferential obligation to the district court and jury that verdict has to shock the conscience, and that we're supposed to defer to the district court, who's in the best position to have appraised the plaintiff, the sister, and the expert's perspective about the impact of this incident. There's a case called Gagliardo where they sustained a $1.5 million verdict. It was an employment case, but the same kind of emotional distress from the trauma, loss of job. How is it that we can do anything on that verdict? Aren't you stuck with that verdict given the deference we owe?
It's a high standard, admittedly, Your Honor, but it's one that involves this court looking at whether the jury reasonably applied the record or whether it simply had sympathy and exercised its sympathy. And we would submit that $1 million in this instance, in a situation which there was $143.50 of tangible damages.
The jury had in front of it, she ended up relocating. An expert said she was in a lifetime need of mental health support. She lost her job. Her sister described a dramatic change in behavior, much like Gagliardo. So given our role, and that evidence, what can we do about that?
Your Honor, if I may, I see my time's expired, but I do think that this is a case in which there's no lost damages proved in terms of a loss of a job. There's no substantial medical treatment or psychological treatment that's issued here that I think the expert opines that she should have therapy for two years at least. And also, she previously, as the expert admitted, previously suffered from anxiety and depression predating the incident. So I think when you look at all of that together, $1 million really does stretch what a jury could reasonably conclude from an instance here.
But our test is shock for conscience.
I think I'd submit that it does, that $1 million.
So what? With 800,000?
Yeah, I'm going.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Where do you draw that line?
I think that the line's at least in the low six figures of what we're, when you look at the other cases that have dealt with similar types of of harm that's not permanent. That's emotional distress, certainly. We don't take away the fact that this was a traumatic incident. But
and the way the complaint was pled, she's on her knees and her clothes falling off, and the dog, you know, the dog was just by her side, according to the complaint. I'm not sure what her testimony was, but she was probably a very sympathetic witness.
I certainly would agree that she's a sympathetic witness, and I think that's what the jury was ultimately pulled by, rather than a reasoned view of the record in terms of her distress, that she was a sympathetic witness. And I think that's what this court has said the juries can't do.
Okay. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Keith West. It's my honor to speak to you on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee Felicia Alvarado. If I may, I would like to address first the jury instruction issue, which was raised, and then the two issues raised by the city on appeal. And at the very beginning, with the court's indulgence, I would like to read a little bit from my notes just because I didn't have a chance to brief that issue, and I just want to cite a few cases for the record. We would argue that the jury issue is not properly before this court for four reasons. One, it would violate the party presentation principle for the Court of Appeals to reach this issue, given that the issue was not raised by the city. Two, the city actually waived that issue, not merely forfeited it. Three, even if the city had merely forfeited any objection to the jury instruction, there are no extraordinary circumstances here for the court to resurrect that issue. And four, in any case, I do actually believe that the district court gave the proper instruction. I'll address that.
Do you contend that the city did not lodge a sufficient objection below?
Your Honor, if I may give the full trajectory of that. So if we look at the record, it is on record pages 168 to 171, where we have the charging conference. And it's a brief entrance in the charging conference. Plaintiff's counsel, who in that situation was me, just said to the judge, we just request the standard jury instruction. And there is a standard jury instruction. I understand it's a finding, but there is a Third Circuit standard jury instruction for Monell, which is number 4.6.7. That's what that's taken from.
But not single incident theory.
So there's the standard jury instruction 4.6.7 that was in effect at that time. That's actually been revisited as recently as spring 2026. And it's the exact same language. In the commentary, there is notes that there is such a thing as single incident, and it could potentially be modified. But it's clearly contemplated within the standard jury instruction. I would just note then that the city at that point, if you look on the record, they do reference that they have alternative language, but they're very vague about what it is. It's clear the judge is having trouble understanding their argument. And then moving from there, we actually go not just merely to forfeit, but waiver. So we just simply ask your judge, just do whatever is most standard. We're trying to be as protective, conservative as possible for this record because we have great facts. We don't want to, you know, have anything happen on appeal. So the judge then at 1100-1101 reads the instruction. I think it's modified, in my personal opinion, is modified appropriately for single incident. The word that the judge repeats over and over as it's actually read is obvious. And that, I believe, is the proper standard for single incident. It's a rare situation, but there needs to be an obvious need, an obvious lack, because it's obviously going to lead to constitutional infections. And I'd like to address why that's our facts here. That's the modification that I see, is the word obvious in there over and over.
And so you think that's consistent with Canton and Connick and Thomas?
Yes. Yeah. Now, but here's the thing. The judge reads that instruction, no objection, right? Now, so at best, we would be there to the issue of plain error, right? But—
Well, the key is whether it was what was done before was sufficient. You don't have to object to jury instructions when they're given if they've already said we want something else.
And so I would say there's nothing in the notice of appeal, the post-trial motion, or the briefing here whatsoever that references what they wanted in the alternative. And they were vague even before the judge. For example, just to cite the Forrest v. Perry case, that's a case I read very carefully because it's one of the cases cited as we should be familiar with. In Forrest v. Perry, it is true that there's a jury instruction that the court revisits because the plaintiff briefed it under the plain error. But if you look at page 101, footnote 4 in that same opinion, there's another issue that the plaintiff failed to brief. And so the court notes that the failure to put that in the appellate's opening brief in the language of Forrest Perry is says it's waived. So there's just absolutely nothing. Now, here's how I understand in this court, there's been a lot of consideration about the difference between forfeiture and waiver in recent opinions. Let me explain why this issue is not merely forfeited, but actually waived, because it's a knowing lack of it. So the defendants in this case, they filed a post-trial motion as referenced in the district court opinion. They raised issues with two separate jury instructions. They briefed that. They asked the trial judge to reverse on that issue. Absolutely nothing at all about Monell jury instruction or anything.
Could I ask you to address the JNOV? Because, yeah, you know, we may agree with you on the jury instructions and not need to go there, but and your friend on the other side says, well, we don't even need to look at jury instructions. The JNOV was wrong. The JNOV does not talk about common area situations. And yet that's really what we're presented with. The knock that is being objected to is the common area misconception. And the district court just talks generally about knock and announce. But your case really is about knock and announce in a common area situation, because that's what happened here. So isn't there a problem with the district court opinion on the JNOV?
Your Honor, respectfully, if I may just, at some point, if I can reserve 10 seconds, I would like to read just three case citations at some point, just for the record. But on the earlier issue, just because we didn't get to brief it, but specifically to your question, that's the I think Your Honor, respectfully, I think it's really highlighting the problem with trying to revisit a trial on an appellate record. So we have these references here that, you know, oh, we thought we were going into a common area, or this looked like a common area, right? The jury in this case, the judge in this case, we all got to see the video, the pictures of the house, the diagram. There's actually testimony cited in our brief where one of the officers admitted that was not reasonable at all. This was not some big apartment building with a foyer.
That is, was not reasonable. The only evidence I remember someone saying it was not reasonable was the expert. I don't remember any of the police officers saying it wasn't reasonable. The only thing I found was the Sergeant Melody reference. Your briefs talk about they were trained to ignore the knocks and announce requirement. And so there were a lot of very bold statements, but I'd like to know where in the record did an officer testify this, we were told to ignore a knock and announce.
Well, Your Honor, these are two separate questions, I think. Judge Schwartz, the officer, I think it's Officer Saab, it's definitely cited in the brief. I'd have to pull up the brief to give me the exact site. But the officer, I mean, just confronted with a picture of the house, said that it was not reasonable to believe that that was anything other than a front door, just the exact issue I said before. And that's the thing, is that this is all kind of pretextual and frankly nonsensical. They went to the front door of a woman's house. They knocked in the door. It was a front door. There's nothing beyond it.
But we have testimony where the officers, and we saw images in the record, there were two mailboxes there. They knew that the person lived on in that building, the second floor. And isn't the question in front of us with the liability for the city, whether there was a failure to train these officers not to breach a door leading to what they suspected to be a common hallway without knock and announce, where the case law says many cases say there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in that area. So how could we fail the city for training on something where there's no expectation of privacy? And the officer said we were trained consistent about what to do with knock and announce.
Right, and Your Honor, I think we're getting really deep into the weeds of contested issues of fact. What is reasonable is inherently a question of fact. Was it reasonable to believe this was anything other than a front door? It looked exactly like the front
door. The officer who made the call, everybody else was behind him. Somebody made the breach. He's the first one who gives the call. And his testimony is, I thought it was a common hallway, and other witnesses testified that they believe they were entering into common space. If that was what they understood themselves to be, mistaken or not, how can we fault the officer's training for that?
Because they didn't believe that. Because their testimony was not credible on that issue whatsoever. So what we have in this case.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
The testimony wasn't credible.
As to what?
As to that they believed it was anything other than a front door. The jury didn't believe them.
But I mean, it seems like we're focusing so much on the officers. And, you know, Hightower has that line, I forget what it's called, the moving force line. You know, I think it's Hightower, you know, line I'm talking about where it says, you know, for there to be vicarious liability, the city has to be the moving force behind the violation. So you could have a bunch of, you know, rogue officers who say, totally well-trained, the training is to the nines, we've got it all. But let's just go in here. You've got an unusual situation where the jury determines, you know, you say it's not credible, but they let every officer off. You know, zero award against the officers, as I understand. You know, big award against the city. And now you're stuck with this kind of awkward moment of trying to say, you let the officers off. How is the city, you know, the moving force behind these violations? And what do you say against the backdrop that single incident theory is, you know, we got this eloquent phrase, vanishingly rare. What's your take on that? How do you say it's vanishingly rare, but it's concrete and touchable here?
Your Honor, thank you for giving me the chance opportunity to address this. So here is the real mechanics of the trial. The mechanics of the trial are that we have eight officers who were dead to rights. They'd clearly violated the knock and announce rule. That was clearly shown by the third party video, and this is in the transcript. Yet the officers, they show up to this property, they wait 2 seconds, they smash in the door. And it is at most 2 seconds.
And you're saying the jury didn't believe that they thought it was like a front of an apartment building?
Absolutely not. I mean, it just simply
was. Was there any testimony to undercut their credibility in this regard?
So the jury was free to make a determination of whether or not were their actions reasonable under the circumstances. There was, you know, argument to say, oh, it was reasonable because we were mistaken and that kind of thing. But
but when you're standing at a door, I mean, you look at the picture and there's two mailboxes. I'm assuming there's a vestibule and two doors inside.
You also have a warrant that says it's the second floor rear. You have a rear entrance. You have the fact that the suspect was on house arrest and they could have just contacted. There's a lot of other facts.
If the officers weren't credible, why didn't the jury tag them with some award?
So this is the issue I want to address. So the officers were dead to rights. I mean, we actually asked for a directed verdict against the officers. The officers had clearly violated the knock and announce rule. So then each of the officers is asked.
What knock and announce rule? Knock and announce rule in common area? When there's a common area? Or a knock and announce rule generally?
Well, the rule is if you're enforcing a search warrant at a private residence, you have to give the occupants of the residence a reasonable opportunity to surrender the premises. And here they didn't do that. They just showed up, smashed the door in. That's Wilson v. Arkansas, Corn Gray. It's an extremely well-established constitutional right.
Right. If you come to my door and you're going to serve a warrant on me, the knock and announce rule necessarily applies, right?
Yes.
But if you're coming to a door like this, maybe not so much. Maybe it's not clear. And if it's not clear, then how is the city, has the city been put on notice that there's a problem here?
I think based on the evidence in this case, the jury reasonably concluded that it was as clear that Ms. Alvarado lived in a private residence with a front door.
That's a different question than Judge Rendell is asking. Judge Rendell is asking, I think, where in the record could we demonstrate that the city would be on notice that its officers did not undertake whatever inquiry they needed to make sure that when they're going to not give the full 30 seconds in the SOP to make sure that it's in fact a common area that they're entering. How would they be on notice of that?
And Your Honor, that's the issue I keep pointing to. So each of the officers is in that situation. Paul asked, did you follow the SOP? The SOP says you're supposed to wait 30 seconds. No, consistently.
But that's
my house. That's at my house.
Right.
They're knocking it out.
And it's also a single, it's one event, although it was done by six people. A single event, regardless of how many people participated, does not make a pattern.
Right. So that's the issue. So then, why did you not follow the SOP? Consistent testimony. The district court highlights this. Consistent testimony was that they had received oral training that they didn't need to do that.
You know, can I just tease out here? You're assuming right now, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, that the SOP provides the exact same standard as is constitutionally required. It may be that the SOP say, you know what, we want you to wait 30 seconds, but if we read the knock and announce rule under the case law, it's really only 10. But just to avoid liability, just to avoid suits like these, our SOP is 30. So if you show up at 25, you have a great case that they violated the SOP, but your suit is for constitutional violations. So don't you have to show more than just a violation of the SOP? Don't you have to show that when it could be mistaken as a common area, that the SOP were, that it's not just a failure to follow the SOP, but it's a failure to follow a constitutional norm? And that there was a lack of training on that?
And Your Honor, that was the consistent testimony in this case. Is that the officers had received actual live oral training that was completely inconsistent with the SOP, and that the jury and the judge, it's clear from his opinion, reasonably inferred from the testimony that the officers had been orally trained that they should not follow the knock and announce. And that was affirmative training from the city.
Don't you have to show the next step for a constitutional violation? Okay, they received oral training that was different than the SOP. That oral training was therefore, that oral training was unconstitutional. So in the hypothetical I was giving, if the city says 30 seconds, but the Constitution requires 10, the only way, and you get oral training of 25, that's not a constitutional violation. If you get oral training of 2 seconds, that might be a violation. So don't you have to kind of show that your violation was in that core constitutional protection, not just contrary to the SOP?
Yeah, and the training that the city actually provided was 2 seconds, or actually, I believe the training really is nothing. So if you look at the video, it's at most 2 seconds.
So there's no audio in the video. Training, that's what happened.
What do you think the constitutional standard is for common area doors? What do you think the constitutional knock and announce standard is for common area doors, fronts of multi-unit apartments? What do you think the knock and announce rule is?
So
assuming it even applies.
If it applies at all.
What is it?
I think, Your Honor, if I can push back on that, we're straying into questions of fact, because that would be a question of fact, whether or not it was
that's
reasonable to believe question. This was a common door.
That's a legal
whether
question.
Whether knock and announce applies is a legal question.
Okay, so the if it's a common door area, I believe there's different case law, which was not contained in the appellant's
that's what
brief.
We have here.
Yeah.
Well, so if that's what we have here, and you have to show violation of the Constitution, or at least the city being the motivating force behind a violation of the Constitution, and they provide no training on common area doors because they think that the Constitution doesn't require knock and announce for common area doors, where's the constitutional violation?
So, again, Your Honor, I think we're the defense made that argument. The plaintiffs made the argument that it's the front door of a house. It's the same as any of our houses. It's just simply the front door of a house.
But in denying the
there was a dog behind the door.
In denying the motion to dismiss, Judge Alejandro, I guess, who plaintiff alleges their injuries resulted from the city's failure to adequately train its office to properly and safely execute warrants of residential properties that contain multiple but separate residences. I mean, that's what has been determined, and that's what you're talking about common area. But here and the district court weren't really talking about common area.
So you know, part of the evidence in this case, the officers admitted that they could hear that there was a dog on the other side of the door. There's also, if you look at the pictures,
did they say other side of the door? From the premises? I mean, they could hear a dog. That didn't mean, that's not an indication necessarily that the space was not still a common area.
I think in most people's common experience, it'd be very rare for a a dog to just be wandering in a common area.
So for you to win, though, don't you have to show that the city had to train the officers that if you hear a dog on the other side of the door, then that means that it's more likely than not that it's not a common area door, it's a single door. Isn't that the point that you have to say is missing from the training? And that's really not what the missing from the training is about. The missing of the training is we armed you with a gun and we didn't tell you how to shoot it. We didn't give you the specifics of what's a dog behind the door.
I think that the jury reasonably concluded from the evidence in this case that the officers knew or reasonably should have known that they were directly entering an occupied space.
Tie that back to the city, though. You're defending the judgment against the city right now. You didn't win much really at all for the officers. You tie that to the city. That's the judgment that you're defending. Assume the officers were just rogue. Walk me through how that's a problem for the city right now.
So that, I always wonder if defense counsel should be allowed to make that argument. He represents both parties. So the officers are all asked, are you rogue cops? Did you violate your training? Every single one of them said, I did exactly what I was told. Yeah, there's a written policy, but I get oral training. And this is what I was actually told to do. That's why they all did the same thing.
What do you claim the trial record reflects regarding the oral training?
So consistently, for example, I think Judge Rendell cited the part of the record says that the officer admits that he did not follow the SOP consistently. And this is cited by the judge and then in our appellate brief. Consistently, the officers say that they followed oral training and live training. Those are the terms that are used.
Right, and I'm asking you, what did they testify to as to what was the components of this oral training the city purportedly provided?
That's the thing. They're showing the video. They're clearly just entering the property. And they say, that's how we're told to do it. For example, there's the testimony where it says,
the city says you don't have to wait 30 seconds. You don't have to wait 30 seconds. You don't have to wait 30 seconds. What does that show that the city was on notice that what they were doing was violating people's constitutional rights? Had there been lawsuits filed on this basis? How do you infer notice that was so obvious that it was going to violate the Constitution? Getting to Judge Phipps' question of, did they have suits where people brought suits because there were, they waited only 2 seconds or 7 seconds or 10 seconds?
Yeah, I mean, I know of at least.
Also, we've got exigent circumstances too. I mean, it's not just a black and white situation, and we have the common area piece too. So, I mean, it's just, you're making it sound like because they said they were trained, automatically, the jury could find that the city was on notice.
So, Your Honor, for example, on the issue of exigent circumstances, each of the officers testified there were no exigent circumstances. Defense has not raised that issue at any point in their brief. So I would say to United States v. Senator Smith, 590 U.S. 371, 2020, it's the United States Supreme Court opinion where the Supreme Court says that the courts of appeal should not reach in to make arguments that are not made by one of the parties. And then there's two precedential Third Circuit opinions that have applied that. United States v. Dowdell, 70 F4th, 134, Third Circuit, 2023. United States v. Payo, 135 F4th, 99, Third Circuit, 2025. All precedential. And
what purpose are those cases being shared with us? Is it be going back to the jury instruction point? Because I know you wanted to make a record concerning that.
Jury instruction, exigent circumstances, any argument not actually raised.
Party presentation. Those are all party presentation cases, right? I'm doing it from memory, but those are all party presentation cases, right?
Yeah, and there's a particularly important issue raised in the two Third Circuit cases that I cited, which is that the party presentation rule is particularly important when one of the parties is the government, because it also goes into the issue of separation of powers. And so the Third Circuit has said in two presidential opinions that when the government fails to raise an argument, it besides all the other issues, it's a separation of powers issues if the Court of Appeals makes the argument on their behalf.
Can I just ask you a question on, this is hypothetical, but what would the city's training have had to look like for you to have said, that's good enough. I'm not going to bring a case against the city. Yeah. Like, so
Yeah, you know, we're just bringing this against the officers. City's training is perfect. There's no way they're going to be the motivating force behind it. Just map out for me kind of what you think the training would look like. Is, oh, that's just above reproach. What do you think that looks like?
If one single person at any point in this case ever, even one single person had ever testified that the training that these SWAT officers had actually received was consistent with the written policies of the city, that might be relevant. Not one single person ever said that the training that the officers actually received had any resemblance to the written policies.
I like
that. And that's a deliberate indifference. The city knew the knock and ask rule existed. They knew they had to have a rule to ensure that it was complied with. And they wrote it down. And then when they actually trained their officers, these SWAT officers, each of them went up on the stand, raised their hand, swore to God, and said, that is not what I was told. And so, really, the city has
anything about common area.
Your Honor, if I may, the city to prevail, the city has convinced this court that the eight officers were lying under oath. And here's the thing.
No, he doesn't have to. That's not what's required. The city to carry its burden has to demonstrate that there was nothing in the record to support the verdict against the city, which is a deliberate Monell liability theory, where there is deliberate indifference arising from a single incident, which requires a showing under the case law that the kind of events that occurred would be so obvious to the city that they had to enhance its training. SOP gives a guidepost that is not what the, and you have to show it's a constitutional violation, not a violation of the SOP, as Phipps said. So I'm not sure that the accusation that the city has to show that their officers were not lying is what the test is.
And I believe there's probably considerable jury sympathy towards the officers in this case. Because let us remember, the knock and announce rule is not only to protect members of the public, it's also to protect police officers. It's to avoid these kind of situations. This rule, the balancing test was already done by the United States Supreme Court in Wilson v. Arkansas. And that's already been established, that this is not the kind of 1983 case where too much is being asked of officers. This is a case that balances all of this. And it's protect the officers from being in these kind of situations, protect members of the public. If you're a police officer and you think you might be entering a private residence, you've got to give the people inside a chance to surrender voluntarily.
That's the rub is, did they believe they were entering a private premises? Did they believe they were entering a common area? Either way, was there a deficiency in the training such that it would be obvious that the city should have trained on this point?
Exactly. You know, the jury believed very reasonably, and the judge makes it clear that he believed it too. The officers believed, or certainly reasonably would have believed, that they were entering a private residence.
That's not the way you pled the case. I mean, on motion to dismiss, the judge said, it's been alleged properly and safely FQ warrants of residential properties that contain multiple but separate residences. That's the way the case has been framed. So whether the jury, you know, did or didn't believe it, it's the way the case has been framed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, what are you citing for?
The motion to dismiss, which was denied by...
Is that at the 12B6 stage?
Judge Quinones, yes. Alejandro.
The case evolves over time. I mean, that's a year.
The case evolves?
So
the evidence also was consistent with the officer's understanding that this
common
was a multi-unit dwelling with, and they were entering a common area. And the question is, what's the problem with the training on that? And your point is they had oral training. I still don't know what you're saying the oral training was. Ignore the rule, the 30-second delay. Well, the Constitution would permit that under certain circumstances, assuming there's a knock and announce requirement as a matter of law.
And that's what the jury, so each of these officers had to admit that they had violated the city's policy, and they had to explain why they did it. And they said, that's what the city told us to do.
Excuse me for one second. I just talked to him.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Council. You can continue.
That's the argument. The argument is they admitted they didn't. They go to a private house. They don't wait. They just knock the door in. They scare this woman. She's naked in her living room. They originally all said that they did wait 30 seconds in the investigation. They're confronted with the video they didn't know existed. And they're asked, is this actually consistent with the SOP? No, of course not. But That's what the city told us to do.
So,
I believe that.
The biggest problem I have for you is attaching this to the city, right? And we've got what really looks like it's, you know, the poster child of single incident liability, which is vanishingly rare. And so I think the more that we lean in and view this as a single is really demanding single incident liability, the worse your case looks. Let me just tease out another way that maybe I'm just speculating. I think you got a high bar on single incident liability. Maybe when you brought the case, it was, but what we've seen in the last few years, this is going to be really, really hard for you to win on that. Could it be that the city's decision to orally train each one of the officers inconsistent with the SOP makes this not quite single incident liability, but makes it almost multi-incident? Each officer received training. Each training was short of what it should be. So when they all go together, this reflects not just one incident of misbehavior that can be blown back to them, but reflects something bigger in the delta between the SOP and what they were actually told. That's I'm just looking for a way to say, because I don't know, really, I don't know that you win. I don't see you winning against the city and getting that verdict in place under single incident liability. And so I'm just saying, has our case law ignored something along the way, some facet of single incident liability that we should consider when there's a delta between SOP and actual training? Should we look into that? Is there any, I mean, you want to tell us about party presentation also. So maybe anything you have is outside party presentation, but I'm still curious.
Yeah, Judge Fitz, and this is a major argument that you know, I tried to make in brief, I thought I cut through. But we don't actually see this as a single incident case. So what is it? What is an incident? An incident is a constitutional violation. It doesn't require that a dog was killed. It doesn't require a fatality. It requires
Monell, the single incident is the only way to not have to show a customer policy. And maybe what Judge Phipps is saying is if you pled customer policy, you might have been on a better thing. But this has to be, you've pled this, it's been tried. And as a single incident case under Monell, has it not?
No, that's our argument, is it's really not. So it's training. This is a failure to train case for sure. Now, the question is—
Custom and pattern? No. Custom and policy?
So there were multiple incidences. So the testimony of the officers is that they were trained that when they actually carry out these warrants, that they shouldn't wait. They should just go straight in. And the testimony in the case was that this group of officers enforced almost every single search warrant in the city.
Right, but the jury didn't have that in front of them. It only had this episode.
But we're talking about one episode. It's a single incident where you're going to put Monell liability on the city based on one single incident. So it's a single incident theory, which requires the deliberate indifference, and the notice is so obviously going to result in a constitutional violation. But I guess we get back to that issue, that it is your single incident theory. It's not, you're not saying there's a customer policy.
May I offer the court a hypothetical? May I offer the court a hypothetical? So imagine the Connell case, right? So Connell, it's the DA case, right? So in that case, the argument was that the district attorney's office of Orleans Parish reasonably believed that the DAs had been trained in the Brady rule, and that they weren't required to provide supplemental training because there hadn't been prior incidences that had resulted in a reversal, right? Now, let us imagine an alternative case. Alternative case where you have a junior person in the prosecutor's office who's handling discovery on a number of criminal cases. And the senior person in the prosecutor's office comes in at the time of trial, he reviews the record. He can see consistently that the Brady materials are not being turned over, but he's able to turn the Brady materials over before trial. Then that same prosecutor promotes the junior prosecutor to handle trials and discovery completely on his own without reprimanding him in any way. Would it be predictable? Even though there hadn't been an actual injury, there had been prior incidences of constitutional violation. Here—
Yeah, but the hypothetical assumes different discrete events. This situation is all of the officers participating simultaneously, how does that give the city notice that there's a problem?
And that's the thing.
That's why I don't think your hypothetical works here, because in this case, we have one episode. Even if we have multiple people behaving exactly the same way, you get around, you get to be able to bring a Monell claim if you can show the city was on notice or the conduct was so obvious that training should have been given.
And that's the language of the district. So just a quote from the district judge's opinion. A training program that affirmatively instructs officers to ignore constitutional guard posts regarding exigent circumstances presents an obvious risk of constitutional violations.
That does not incorporate a common area consideration. And that's what we have here.
And we
need to show that there have been these common area violations that the city knew and knew that they needed to train on how, when you see three mailboxes or two mailboxes, you got to look at the back. You got to figure out what it could be. You got to ask people, how many people live here? Is there a vestibule? You got to do something extra when you have this.
And Your Honor, again, I just respectfully, I just don't think that that was credible under the facts that the jury saw. It just wasn't believable.
I like to look at it that way, though. Your complaint says invading residences for which no warrant applied. So your pleading talks about the common area entrance.
Right, and if you look at, say, opening statements, closing statements, you know, and for example, closing statements, it's clearly stated over and over that it's pretextual. When they're claiming to have been confused by a common area, it's not believable. Closing statements say you saw the evidence, you saw the video, you heard the testimony of the officer who said it wasn't reasonable to actually believe that. I mean, again, there's an officer who actually testified in this case that it wasn't reasonable to believe that this was anything other than a front door.
Okay, I'd like to ask you about the verdict. Your adversary argues about remitter. We look at publicly available sources for other, like, docketed cases with verdicts that are ranging from $1,500 to $170,000. What role should that play in us determining whether this verdict is conscience shocking? When they were like events with confrontations between an individual and with law enforcement entering premises or other property.
I don't think it plays hardly any role at all. Again, this is an issue where we have to defer to the jury. For example, with expert testimony in this case that from the perspective of Ms. Alvarado, this was a PTSD syndrome. That was very similar to as if she had been sexually assaulted. Now, if we had a rape case and the jury gave $1 million, would there, anyone
testify to that?
She did. It's in the record. She specifically said this is akin to a sexual assault or a physical assault. That's directly in there and uncontradicted.
So
contrary testimony.
The question I had for you was very simple. Yeah. What role should these other verdicts are markedly less than what this jury verdict found? And you said none.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next question. Let's assume that we grant relief that your adversary seeks. We vacate we reverse the verdict. We reverse the judgment as a matter of law. Do you agree you are no longer a prevailing party, even though you had the liability versus against the officers, because there were no damages or other relief offered?
Well, no.
The attorney fees go away, too. Am I correct?
No, we clearly prevailed against each of the officers.
You have a liability verdict, but the definition of a prevailing party is that there has to be a change in the legal relationship between the two sides. And in this instance, with no damages being awarded, there's no obligation by the officers to do anything vis-a-vis the plaintiff. And so doesn't that put the attorney fees award at risk as well?
I think there would still be the nominal damages issue, but
there was no award of nominal damages in this case. There was zero. Yeah. The verdict sheet was zero.
I do actually believe that there is some briefing on there's at least one case I'm aware of where there was a $0 verdict, but attorney's fees were still awarded.
Understood. Okay. Dr. Rendell, anything further?
No.
Phipps.
No.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much for your arguments. We'll hear your adversary on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Just give me one second. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief, and I just want to go back to the point on JNOV. What I think Your Honor's questions really get at is this issue of notice for purposes of the city, whether the city was on notice such that it was deliberately indifferent. And again, that happens in one of two ways. It's obvious it's one of the exceedingly rare, vanishingly rare extreme cases, or it's a situation in which you have a pattern. And I don't think anything that my friend on the other side said shows that this rises to the level of the hypothetical in Canton, the idea of arming police officers. Again, we're talking about particular training as to how to apply the knock and announce rule in the situation in which officers expect to encounter a exterior door.
But your colleague is saying, no, that's not it. It's just plain old knock and announce. It really wasn't reasonable for anybody to think that this was common area, and the jury didn't believe that they thought it was common area. And yet I thought that it was pled as common area. Tell me where I'm going wrong.
It is, Your Honor, and I think those are two aspects of the Fourth Amendment that were claimed to be violated here by the plaintiff. And one is the idea that the officers should have done something more to realize that this is not an exterior door, that this is an interior door. They should have, you know, reconned the.
That's not before us.
Well, it's certainly not addressed by the plaintiff in the brief, and it's not addressed by the district court, as Your Honor pointed out in the opinion. We point out in our brief why that fails, and it fails for the exact same reason. There's no prior instance of a constitutional violation that would have put the city on notice. There's no pattern, and it's not training officers in how exactly to determine whether a door that they believed was an exterior door but turned out to not be. To train them to make that determination better is a nuanced type of training that's not one of these categorical extreme failures to train. So what that leaves the plaintiff with here, oh, Your Honor, I see I've run out of time. If I might briefly wrap up, where that leaves the plaintiff ultimately is with the claim that, well, the officer's testimony that because what they did was consistent with their training, that means that this must have happened on previous instances. And that's just not supported by the record. And I would direct Your Honors to Hightower, in which this court dealt with the same type of claim. And I think an even stronger record for the plaintiff in that case that, well, there was this deputy warden that testified that I think this had occurred on prior occasions, no detail provided about any of those prior instances. This court in Hightower called that deposition testimony empty and unable to support a verdict in favor of the plaintiff so that summary judgment was granted. And that's the same here. It can't support a pattern. The mere bald testimony that's very unremarkable that the officers did what they did was consistent with their training. It just shows that any constitutional violation occurred in a prior instance. And that's what's required for deliberate indifference here. So unless Your Honors have any further questions, I would ask this court to grant to reverse the decision below and grant judgment as a matter of law in favor of the city.
That is a big deal, though, undoing a verdict. You know, the jury's the one that heard all the evidence. We are very, you know, we defer to juries. We believe they take their instructions seriously, and they heard all the evidence. So it's asking a lot.
We're mindful of that, Your Honor, but it's the court has a gatekeeping function too, and that is making sure that the law, which says that single incident liability is exceedingly rare, is not presented to the jury in a case in which it's not supported by the record. And I want to reiterate why single incident liability is so important that bar is high. And the reason that bar is high, as the Supreme Court has explained, is because without that high bar, you risk in a failure to train claim, which is the most tenuous type of claim, you risk turning 1983 Monell into respondeat superior. And that's exactly what the courts have said, why this is a high bar, why the evidentiary burden is such a high one, because juries will, this can very much turn into, well, the officers did something improper, something went wrong, they must be liable, the city must be liable, it's their employer after all. And that's what the cases say you have to avoid, because 1983 doesn't allow for respondeat superior liability.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. The court thanks both counsel for their incredibly helpful arguments and their briefing. We are going to go off the record and we